I was in the privileged position of feeling you fight, Harrow continued, fingers nervously flexing, and it took me a while to figure out what you were doing. Longer still to appreciate it. But I don't think I'd ever really watched you, not in context. Well, all I can say is thank the tune that nobody knows you're not really one of ours. If I didn't know that, I'd be saying you were Matthias Nonius come again or something equally saccharine.
You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, episode 16, Companionable Silence.
This is the chapter that when this book is shared with a friend, you are sitting waiting by your phone, knowing what is about to happen.
Like when I've passed this book to somebody, I'm texting them like, has it happened yet? And they're like, has what happened? And I'm like, you'll know.
You'll know.
You'll know.
You'll know. It is really interesting to go into this like very technical bonding moment where we are having like Gideon's connection to Thanergy, Harrow's dedication to study, their real cementing of their relationship as like a unit, like experiencing things together is the theme of this chapter in a very, very big way.
I had not noticed until we started looking at this deep dive chapter by chapter how much Tamsin Muir loves to do contrast structurally. Yeah. She loves to do a chapter where there's two things and the difference between those things tells you something about what's happening. And this is such a strong example of that because this is a turning point in two different directions at the same time. The bulk of this chapter is devoted to like, what if Gideon and Harrow could actually work together productively and solve problems as a team?
Yeah.
And the end of this chapter is like, this is a horror book, by the way.
But it's also like there's this kind of foreshadowing of what happens when someone can work together with between Adept and Cavalier. Like they become such a potent team that it is immediately very, very apparent how powerful that collaboration is. And in the prior chapter and in the prior episode, we talk about the potency of the relationship and collaboration and understanding and teamwork between the Adept and the Cavalier of the Fifth and how Kithareya would perceive that as a threat. So we're coming off of this situation where we're seeing unity amongst the different houses and the conversation and the empowerment of them connecting. And we're seeing more of that connection between Harrow and Gideon. And then we're seeing the consequences of that connection and empowerment and mutual support being visible by the end. And that is that, like, if you don't think you're in danger, you're wrong. You have this sense of safety that, you know, Harrow and Gideon walk away from this experiment with, you know, a sense of gratification and connection and, like, peace that is part of the previous chapter.
I think the context of the previous chapter is so important in shaping everything that happens, not just at the end of this chapter, but also through the body of it.
Yeah.
The skull at the top of this chapter is a fifth house skull. They are leaving the anniversary party and going straight down into the facility to work on this puzzle. They are immediately coming off this encounter with the fifth as a couple, not just as Adept and Cavalier, but as a marriage. And frankly, neither Harrow nor Gideon have seen a lot of romantic modeling in their real lives. You know, Harrow's parents, not exactly warm and cuddly with one another, as they are both dead. So similarly, like the other people that we know from their childhood who are married, there's not romance and tenderness and consideration and bond. So in the same way that like the way that they interact with each other shifts after they get some insight into how Palamedes and Camilla interact, this is another model. And they have started to sort of acknowledge in their interactions with each other that there is some romantic interest. And then they see this romantic, adept cavalier relationship that seems absolutely perfect. And they go straight from that into like, all right, let's tackle this as a team. And this is an experiment that's really informed by that experience.
And it really explicitly, quickly on in this chapter's writing, acknowledges the contrast. Like, Hera is inside of Gideon's brain, and Gideon is recognizing that under almost every circumstance that she's ever engaged with Hera, not participating, resisting, hating everything about this would be absolutely the norm.
And Hera is being vocally encouraging instead of being a dick. She's
Yeah.
saying, you can do this. You got this. You are skilled enough to handle this. You can do a good job. I believe in you. Instead of
Yeah.
being like, whatever, she's useless. She
I don't
sucks.
even
She's an
think
idiot.
of you, Griddle. Like, there's no barbs at all in their interaction here. There's, in fact, a highlight of the absence of it.
Yeah.
Explicitly in the text, recognizing the lack of hostility.
Caro is communicating what she needs to Gideon, and Gideon is meeting her with what she needs. And they're both really uncomfortable with that. This is new. This is
Yeah.
really at the edge of their emotional capacity.
And even though they're like, this is new, this is weird, it's not hard for them to recognize each other's skill, which means that that has always been present. This is them recognizing each other's skill. Like, while Harrow is like, oh, wow, your sword fighting's really actually quite extraordinary, that's not a hard thing for her to really acknowledge. She's just like, I never really looked at it before. And now she's like, I've had this intimate look. And you know, Gideon is trusting the in some ways very obscure instructions. Like, Hera's framed this ahead of time, being like, okay, there's all these Thanagenic theorems, they're put together, I have to deconstruct it piece by piece. Like, Gideon understands the framework of the communication, but Hera was just like, target, target, target. And just trusting Gideon. And Gideon is trusting those targets, and they're operating, each of them, in their peak capacity.
And Gideon actually opted into that and initiated it. She said, tell me what to do. It wasn't Harrow demanding and Gideon resisting. It was Gideon saying, I recognize your role. You need to be making decisions and then trust me to act.
Yeah, we get a little bit of sword fight foreshadowing here, where, you know, even in the first line, Gideon is like trying to hold a rapier in a defensive position, which, like, if you know anything about rapiers versus long swords, is fucking comical. Like, a rapier, you don't block with a rapier, you parry, you deflect. If something is coming down hard on you, you want to deflect and step away. You don't want to be like trying to use that as a wall, but you can feel Gideon's craving for the tool that makes sense to her. She sees that this is limiting. And there's a little bit of that for Harrow as well, as she recognizes that she doesn't quite fully understand what this experiment was designed to do, as the kind of curious qualities that Gideon specifically has brought to it start to emerge around Gideon's observation of these what appear to be Thanagenic hotspots.
So, yeah, getting into sort of the mechanics of this, Harrow in this mind link with Gideon is recognizing the places where the theorems that build this construct come apart. And the way to solve the puzzle is to direct Gideon to hit them. And so it's not a brute force sort of mechanic, it's a targeting mechanic. And Harrow is surprised that Gideon can also see these hotspots when they are mind linked. Now, earlier, I thought that this was evidence for my secret Gideon force sensitive theory, but I actually think that it's evidence against. Because I was like, Gideon can see these, and Harrow doesn't think that she should be able to see them. And that's evidence that, like, maybe Gideon is actually necromantic, but I actually think that it's about the permeability of the link. When Harrow is in there, Gideon can see stuff that only Harrow can see. And I think that's more that Gideon is getting some Harrow.
And if we're going to build on what we were talking about earlier about, you know, relationship modeling, willingness, consent, collaboration, the permeability is a result of the relationship. Like, I think that aspect would be much less prevalent if Gideon wasn't fighting this. The openness to each other, the openness to each other's skill, collaboration, and like mind is what allows that transference of sense. You know, Gideon, just as you said, sensing Harrow's awareness of the thanergetic points, but also later on, Harrow talking about sensing Gideon's capacity as a fighter. Like, they're struggling initially to normalize their expectations of what they should be sensing to this new setup as they are kind of mind melded. But once they start to settle into it, once the like jarring unfamiliarity eases, it becomes much more natural. And we talked in an earlier episode about how one of the points of this experiment perhaps was to develop an appreciation and understanding of what's possible with that yielding and unification. Which, like, if you think about Lictor, like, that is a key part, is yielding and unification.
Yeah, and I think it unfortunately does give a clear answer to a question that we raised in an earlier episode, which is, does it hurt the whole time for Gideon? And the answer is yes. And it hurts enough that Gideon is complaining about it.
Yeah. You know, looking at the kind of priorities and tolerances that the initial, you know, necromantic research must have been fine with to develop these theorems, to develop these practices, like the amount of suffering that the original adepts and calves must have willingly continued going through when they didn't know this would work, when they were trying different things, must have been enormous, repetitive, with no promise of success.
Yeah, and as is a continued theme through the series, the suffering and the sacrifice is asymmetrical within the context of really intimate bonds. And that's really morally difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is a kind of lack of resolution around the morality of it, where it's like, okay, they're saying yes, but it's not okay. Like, them saying yes doesn't make it okay.
Yeah, you have to imagine the original, particularly the absolute, like, first Lictors must have been driven by such a sense of desperation.
Yeah. I feel like the writing in this first half of this chapter buries the lead a little bit, because it's very much still the same pacing as the last time they did this experiment. It's like, oh, we're fighting, and here's the sword, and there's experiments, and there's the quonk sound, and the beeps, and the... Which was about different things when this kind of writing was seen earlier on in the book. But now it is about the relationship. And, you know, about what has changed in their experiencing of it now that they've, you know, experienced Pal and Cam, experienced Abigail and Magnus. Like, you know, the motions in some ways look the same, but the experience that they're having internally has drastically changed.
Totally. Yeah, just it's such a subtle difference. It's so easy to read this on the level of like, there's a big bone guy and Gideon's fighting it. Yeah. But the way that they're interacting is so, so different. Where in the first one, you know, Harrow made a plan. Gideon thought the plan was stupid. Gideon just did her own thing. Then they sort of like kind of wedged themselves into a cooperation that was kind of working, but it really wasn't super collaborative. Whereas here they're like actually fucking communicating with each other in real time and giving each other both positive and negative feedback, giving each other information. The fact that Harrow has started providing Gideon with information, like proactively saying, this is how long it's going to take me to finish what I'm doing. That's never happened before. That's a huge change.
She's giving Gideon the opportunity to anticipate, plan, and strategize independent of Harrow's plan.
Yes.
She's saying, this is where I'm going. This is what to expect me to do. Do your thing.
Yeah. And there's this give and take where Harrow facilitates Gideon's autonomy and Gideon willingly surrenders some of her autonomy at the same time. both in the sense that, like, literally Hera is in her body, camping out in her brain, but also that she's saying, like, tell me what you need me to do, I will do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And if we're going to continue, you know, contrasting that in a, like, the relationship of the Lictor unity and, like, the morality of that, like, it still is that kind of, like, give and take exploration. And here's my anticipation. You know, we're going to keep seeing this theme explored until we see it hit that point where it feels morally bad.
You could just say Yanthe.
Don't just like, oh, Babs.
Because it clearly what's happening with Yanthe's experience with Babs is really different. The consent does not look like this. It is not a willing sacrifice in the same way, even though we know that he is willing to give up parts of his body for her power.
Yeah.
And, like, what would it look like to integrate an unwilling cavalier and an unwilling cavalier who you've never had this brain-to-brain interaction with?
And I think one of the interesting pieces in with the third is Corona's element in upholding entitlement to that. Like, Corona is portrayed so much more often throughout the book so far as this, like, much more friendly, benevolent, like, playful, likable person. But, like, Corona is a participant in what Babs experiences. I was recording a chapter for someone and I was going through that scene where, like, Corona just fucking rips Bab by the ear and is like, apologize to her. Like, Corona absolutely enforces what Yanthe believes is her right to everything of Babs.
And part of why Corona makes a really good enforcer is she's physically powerful.
Yeah. She's physically powerful and not just, like, in her body, but in her presence. Her physicality is socially powerful. But there's an element of disarming to it where you don't see it obvious right away. You know, we see it specifically when Gideon is not known to be there. She's not known to be observed by Corona and Babs, but when Yanthe realizes it, she's like, don't fuck around. Like, I know you're in there and I know what you just saw. And you know, Yanthe is threatened by the perception of this power dynamic unveiled. Yeah, and so we can start to see, and that is in one of the ways, one of the first, well, the first one we really get a picture of is Dulcinea and Protesilaus, which is obviously not a natural adept cavalier relationship that is perceived. It's not a whole other
full stop.
And then we get some of the third. So we're getting all these different pieces, but the one that has left the most impact is Abigail and Magnus and Palamedes and Cam, because they've really taken the time to actually connect with Hera and Gideon as people, compared to Kithareia, who has immediately developed a manipulation of Gideon, and Yanthe, who has just threatened them.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think Kithareia's portrayal of the Cav-Necro relationship probably is a little off-putting to Gideon, because they spend so much time apart in the same way that the Ninth have been up till that point. So it doesn't offer her a model that is the thing that she wants. It offers her a model that's closer, it seems on the surface, to the thing that she already has.
Which I think in some ways the third is also could be described as that, which, you know, is this entitlement to everything that is Babs. Like, Babs's body, Babs's time, Babs's attitude, Babs's relationship with the world around him. It is all at the discretion of Yanthe and Kron.
That's totally true. I actually was thinking in terms of Kithareia spends a ton of time without Pro around. And so that sort of that atomization of the relationship is more similar to how Hera has been treating Gideon. And so that's not appealing. And I think you're also right that that's happening in the third, but I think that's not actually visible to Gideon yet. Gideon doesn't know that Yanthe is spending a lot of her time alone.
Yeah, there's just a kind of emotional hostility that is familiar.
Totally. The hostility, I think the entitlement, the we've talked about the, like, really harsh correction, the sort of humiliation aspect, totally there.
Yeah.
And I think there's an aspect of humiliation to how Kithareia treats Protesilaus as well. It's not as mean, but it is really condescending.
Yeah, the like stand, pat, 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 sit beside
Oh,
me.
you silly man.
Yeah. I don't recall right now, but I know we do get to experience Dulcinea and Protesilaus as their actual selves later on, I believe in Harrow. And like right now, I'm deeply craving actually seeing them as Adept and Cavalier in reality and knowing what their relationship was really like.
It seems from the letters that their relationship was really familial and trusting and respectful. It seems like the real Dulcinea interacted with Protesilaus sort of as like a favorite uncle.
They're so soft. That's so sweet. Rather than the other uncle
Yeah, no,
situation that we
not a
have
mayonnaise
going
uncle, a
on.
regular real uncle.
More of the kind of uncle that we like, rather than the kind of, uncle that's gonna steal my life juice.
Yeah, but it seems like he and his wife sort of got to playfully push her around and insist that she rest and that sort of thing. And so that's a very different relationship to her sort of, oh, you silly man, I get to make all the decisions and you're stupid. Which, like, it makes sense that Kithaeria is choosing that because he is a puppet. And so, like, dismissing him is a reasonable social strategy in the situation, but it's not a nice cavalier dynamic.
Yeah, when you're perceiving Protesilaus as a whole person, it feels gross. And even as a puppet, it feels kind of awful to see the way that he acts. Like, there's a coldness, there's an indifference, there's a cruelty in the character that Kithaeria is creating out of the pro puppet.
Yeah, because he doesn't have any emotional reaction to anything. And so it seems like, as much as Gideon obviously is completely Twitter-pated about Kithaeria, there's also an element of like, she's not going to treat you nice. You know that, right?
We see how she treats people that she has decided serves her. She makes a tool out of Pro and she makes a toy out of Gideon immediately. I would love to dig into some of the like physiology and like body sensation stuff that Mir chooses to use in this. The one that's jumping out to me right now is as Harrow is deeply embedded in Gideon's mind. They're like really unified. There is an oily, warm feeling in the back of her throat.
I found the description of nausea really, really accurate.
Ah, right. Because it's not like an acid reflux. Because that was the thing where I was like, acid reflux is a metallic, acrid kind of feeling. It's not oily and warm.
Yeah, it's just her mouth is she's got this like drooliness happening and this oily, yeah. I at the risk of I guess like trigger warning, emetophobia. I got car sick recently for the first time in a really long time because I moved to the Midwest and so there's no hills. And I went up to the mountains and someone else was driving and I threw up just out of motion sickness. And it was exactly that feeling of like, I knew at first I was like, oh, I'm gonna feel nauseous, but I'm not gonna throw up. And then my mouth started filling with saliva and I was like, oh, I'm about to throw up.
It gives the impression that like this isn't something that Gideon experiences a lot in her body. Often, we'll have in Mir's writing, when something is unfamiliar to the character that is narrating, the language they will use will be very different from the kind of colloquial language that we as people and readers would use to describe this thing.
Yeah, and we see Gideon gloss over particularly the experience of pain very
Yes.
frequently, where she'll say, you know, even on the same page, Gideon nearly got her leg broken. It's not clear whether that's a minor injury or a near miss because like it doesn't matter to her. It's all the same. And so like we're not getting sensory description of pain, but yeah, we're getting this like blow by blow, second by second description of the development of nausea, which tells us, yeah, that's not a thing she's used to ignoring.
And so, we get a picture of what happens in the living body as this integration with thanergy between two people starts to develop and enmesh deeper and deeper. What I'm seeing is the body being like, this is bad. I don't like it.
Yeah, all of the different vision distortions are really interesting to me.
Yeah.
And I know that as someone with very poor vision myself, when something happens like a contact lens slips out of place or gets lost, that like sudden unexpected vision distortion is something that I find so distressing and it feels so helpless. And I can only imagine Gideon in the middle of a fight, having her vision distorted would be really upsetting.
Yeah, and you know, especially when this moment and this experience is emotionally quite unprecedented already. She is chosen to be receptive and vulnerable in a way that she has not once in her life ever done before. And in the exact same experience, she is also having to physically experience things that she probably has never in her life experienced before. Discomforts deep and overwhelming across her body, you know, in her bones, in her brain, in her throat, like, and she is still unerringly committed to what she is trying to do with Harrow. And has not at any point in that experience of her body's resistance mentally started resisting Harrow.
And also, like, just to highlight the immediate context, she is literally fighting a giant monster. A thing that is not part of her day-to-day life.
Yeah.
She is used to fighting people-sized and shaped monsters, and that is a normal part of her life. This is a whole new thing. We have no reason to think that she has ever seen something like this before.
Especially confirmed given that Harrow has never really seen anything like this before, and given that most of the monsters she fought are Harrow specials.
And she's not like drawing a parallel between, like, this is something from out of my comic books. Like, no, this is just an unprecedented concept.
Yeah. We have a lot of like fast shifts in sensation. Her vision blurred and then abruptly spiked back abruptly to 2020 color. Which like implies that it's not just a blurring, it's a saturation. So there are so many different aspects of sensory disorientation that are simultaneously happening. And I would be curious, you know, out of all of the various things that I'd love to map in great detail, is the various pieces that like map to different types of necromancy. Different types of interaction within the body and its soul and its spirit and its element of thalergy, like the nerves in the eyes, the rods and cones. What the fuck is going on? That it's, you know, the muscles in the eyes controlling the dilation of the pupils, like light amounts, focus, saturation. These are all different structures within the eye that are being affected in discrete and separate ways simultaneously at different paces as Harrow is fucking around in Gideon's brain. And I can only assume that Harrow is like poking at various bits to try and see what happens. And some of them work and some of them don't. And when Harrow stops poking a thing, maybe Gideon's sensation kind of comes back to what she expects. Like, Harrow is it has like a bunch of buttons and doesn't know what any of them and doesn't know what any of them do.
Yeah, I almost sort of, I guess I was imagining more like Harrow is trying desperately to get herself situated in a way that feels secure. And as she is shifting within the sort of semi-literal space, it's putting different pressures on different
Yeah.
systems. I think of her less as sort of actively pushing buttons, not that she wouldn't, but I see them both as really kind of disoriented and a little bit sort of scrabbling in this moment.
There's like I try and think of different metaphors for what this experience would be like. And the one that's coming to me most right now is like two people who are like bodily very connected, holding each other at some way, moving through like some combination of ball pit and crowd and molasses. Like there's all of these different sensories and textures, but they're having to stay connected within it. And they're having to understand that they're moving independently, but not fully independently from each other. And it's constantly giving them new stimulus. But there is, as they get used to it, a degree of predictability and familiarity, both from each other and from the environment. It's just, in this first moment, all new.
Here's the metaphor that I'm imagining. Two people are collaboratively driving a car using only their hands, and Gideon is on the gas and brake.
I'm driving. Yeah. I like in some ways maybe, we have because there's also the increased amounts of types of senses that is added to this car once you add a necromancer to the mix. The radio is blaring and the music is questionable. And someone's shouting at you from the back.
It's very hot.
And something smells.
This scene, and particularly sort of what you bring up about the sensory stuff, raises questions for me about what teachers' sensory experience is like on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. And, continuing along my theory that teacher is a very particularly designed thing, what would teacher need to have put into his setup that would be relevant for his role?
Like maybe
Because
he's having a more dulled experience rather than a super intense one.
some of it would be like, I imagine getting some sort of read on whether someone is a lictor or not might be a relevant sense for teacher to have. What is relevant for teacher to operate? But I do think some of the senses that we would experience would be completely irrelevant and might be like residual as just side effects of the stuff that he's made of and the model of what he's made. Like he's made of person stuff in the shape of a person, so he might have some things that we would find in common, but what he actually needs to operate is not what we've developed. That said, often in people designing things, we will project ourselves onto the things we design. We will project our relationing to the world. Like, there's a wonderful series. So Robin Wall Kimmerer, who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass, was an editor on this wonderful 5-book series that I'm going through right now, I think called the Kinship series. But there's this one piece in it that like is, I think it's called Wild Ethics and the Something of Something. But what it's talking about is how we often will project our senses onto our understanding of animals experiencing the world, where it's like, oh, well, this monarch butterfly must have, this relationship to the orientation of the sun and its circadian rhythms and blah, blah, blah. Like using the language of our bodily experience to the world to describe it, where it's like, why wouldn't the world just be like breathing in butterflies? To think that these other things need to be as we are is so minimizing, but is an inherent, narcissism of human creators. When we think about robots and androids, we are like, oh, they are people shaped. We want them to be uncanny valley. Like, we really don't look at them as unique things within their unique context. So there's a kind of balance between the fact that teacher is a very purpose created thing, but is created with the conceit of John.
This reminds me of the way people struggle to understand what large language models are doing. I was seeing some conversation earlier this morning, actually, about ChatGPT giving bad information about legal precedent. And people were like, why does it lie about the law? This seems like a really serious thing. It shouldn't be giving bad information about this. And it was like, oh, it doesn't know things. It doesn't know which things are true, and it can't know that. That's not how it works at all. And yeah, if you come to ChatGPT with a starting assumption that it is thinking, that it is doing the same sorts of things that you're doing when you provide language, you're going to totally misunderstand why it's acting like it's acting.
And so I love, even thinking of the other priests, like if you think that they're designed the same way teacher is, they don't work the same way he does, so I'm gonna go with no. And there's even a line early on where Gideon's like, I wonder if they like live in a closet all the time because they're not very animated and teacher is so vital. Like, yeah, they're different things. They're different. They're shaped the same way because they're designed to be interacting with people, and people want to interact with people, or else we get really weird in our brains because that's why we murdered all the Neanderthals.
I think we mostly fucked the Neanderthals. I think we've moved away from that hypothesis.
Oh, that's good to know. I mean, I'll. I'll chew on that one. I mean, I don't know. Like, they're still not here anymore, so that's its own thing.
No,
But
I think there was an interbreeding thing, and like the there was a sort of collapsing
convergence and
difference.
collapsing of. Oh, okay. But still, the you know, in our design of robots and our concept of androids, it is that same thing where like we find great comfort in being like, this thing is us. This thing is like us. This is an us thing, rather than this is a tool. This is a construct. This is a non-thing, and it's just serving a purpose. But Caden House was designed to be a place where people could really grow and preserve and develop knowledge, and having emotionally distant skeletons being most of their interactions wouldn't really facilitate the further development of more lictors. Like, sure, the initial lictors having like maybe some more rudimentary research conditions is plausible. But like to continue building on that, especially when it's like maybe desperate conditions and deeply uncomfortable, you want sympathetic, comforting surroundings, including sympathetic, comforting carers, not just like graceful skeletons. And when you think about this giant bone construct, like it's just designed to be terrifying and threatening. It's designed to be challenging beyond any individual cavalier or individual adept's capacity to handle alone.
But also, it's designed to be only medium threatening. It's not designed to hit super hard. It's not designed to be swift and deadly. It's designed to be something that you can only take apart a certain way. And that really, like you said, motivates you to want to take it apart.
Motivates you want to get apart. And then, you know, the bone construct combined with the structure of the lab itself limits the cavalier and the adept in a way that forces collaboration. And that itself is what we've determined is the point, is like it's the relationship building. There's like a medium challenging thing that maybe one of them, without their any limitations, could handle. But like each of them being limited and separated from each other and having some of their skills handicapped, they have to rely on each other a little bit more and discover what that relationship of relying on each other could be. It's just really lovely to see that click, and then this like peaceful moment of like, you know, the sand ebbing away into the grate, and like this, you know, the writing slows down. It really slows down for a moment. The
There's a really lovely payoff.
yeah. One last final thing before we get into that payoff is just like Gideon's like, fuck this sword, punch. Just like, it's so gratifying. Gideon's like, okay, we're done here. I don't have to use this goddamn rapier anymore. I'm just gonna punch this thing and be done with this.
So
And then
this
we get our.
thing. Yeah, it collapses into sand and it reveals this beautiful shining black box with a lovely the fucking language, a deep juicy scarlet key. This lovely, like, this triumphant moment. You have defeated the dungeon and you have unlocked the treasure and you've got it.
It's unlocked the treasure, but then it's also like them unlocking their understanding of what just happened. They're sitting there being like, you saw this and you did this. And then, like, now that they're no longer in the heat of the moment, starting to realize what they just did.
Imagine having the kind of relationship where it makes sense to debrief with each other.
Wild. Never once happened before for either of them at any point, really, in their lives.
And Gideon really expects, when she's like, oh, I saw this glowing thing. And when Harrow says, like, oh, you shouldn't have been able to see that, Gideon kind of ex thinks that she's like telling her that she didn't see it, that she's lying, that she's wrong, you know. And Hera's like, no, I believe you. I just like that. That demands explanation. And so she's treating Gideon as credible in a way that Gideon's not expecting.
And I think in a way that Gideon didn't even think of that information as unique and novel to Harrow, in the way that she starts to see Harrow react. And as Harrow is treating Gideon as credible, seeing that Gideon has unique, valuable information that she needs to include in her processing, Harrow is developing this like feeling of like, you wanna do you wanna like solve puzzles with me, Gideon? And Gideon's like, ah.
And this information, the fact that Gideon could see these lights, immediately changes how Hera is understanding the situation. And she acknowledges that. She's not just privately processing information in her own brain. She's saying, like, oh, this raises uncertainty for me. Now I feel less sure of the situation. Like, what? Epistemic humility?
It is really fascinating and honestly a little surprising to me to see how quickly they pivot.
Totally.
Like Gideon is in some ways not in a position to really argue, but seeing this pivot in Hera was honestly kind of surprising for me, where I was like, where was this person been hiding the whole time? Like I haven't seen Hera interact with anybody in this way at any point. This openness, this inquisitiveness, this trust. Gideon is just as stunned as I am. And then like Gideon's like really paying attention to Harrow's face and having a lot of feelings about that.
The thing that Hera says to Gideon about her fighting is it feels like almost word for word the thing that Gideon fantasized about Hera saying about her fighting someday. And I'm like, how close is it? I have to know. Because in this chapter, Hera says, but for the love of the Emperor Griddle, you are something else with that sword. And
Just
I'm like,
fanning
that's
self.
all she wanted in the world was that sentence. That's what she wanted. And she thought she was going to have to go be like a war hero to get it.
And Gideon's only explanation for this in this moment is you must be brain damaged.
Yeah, not possible. Shut up. Go away. Okay, so this is a callback to chapter 12.
12, okay.
When Harrow is missing, Gideon talks about these routine fantasies that she has, in which she is part of the first strike on an invasion dropship, and somewhere across the universe, Harrow Hark opens an envelope that talks about how incredibly brave and critical Gideon was to the fight, and she's won a huge percentage of prize money, and her role is outstanding, and she looks hot while she's fighting. And Harrow reads this report very seriously, and her lips curl, and she drawls out something like, "Turns out Griddle could swing a sword after all." And that fantasy gets her, that's like the main motivator to get her through her workouts. The thing that Harrow actually says is, "For the love of the Emperor, you are something else with that sword." This is a level of positive feedback that is literally beyond her wildest dreams.
Also, like, if someone said that to me, I'd be like,
Oh, totally. Oh,
I would
totally.
just die.
A little bit, yeah.
I want to die.
The blood all drained away from Gideon's cheeks for some reason.
For some reason, the unity of adept and cavalier and gay panic feel very similar.
Yeah,
It
mooches.
feels on point for this book.
So Harrow insists that they immediately go find out what this key unlocks. And of course, she's already documented all of the locked doors in the building. I want to highlight one of the meanest single sentences in the book, which is, "She'd eaten a good meal, she'd won the game, the world seemed less maliciously unfriendly." And they walk out of the lab and immediately encounter the mangled corpses of Magnus and Abigail.
And like the writing in this is so paced. Like you're just like, what's going on? What is going? And then it doesn't deliver that final realization until the very end. And it coaxes it where it's like Gideon almost knows, Gideon almost understands. She can feel that something of gravity is happening here, but the language is that denial.
Something has changed for Harrow, and she is first aware of Harrow, and then she follows what Harrow is looking at. And then she still has to sort of decode what she's looking at and make sense of the bodies.
And I think this is maybe one of those moments where the tone of fan content and the tone of relationships between art that we make for each other within the fandom. Like, either you're in it or you're out by the end of this chapter. Because this is now the relationship that the author is forming with the readers. She's like, we've spent 15 chapters learning about some people that we're going to get invested in. And guess what? Shit's gotten bad.
I'm going to hold your hand when I say this. I'm going to kill all those nice people.
And it immediately establishes a type of relationship to the content, to the medium, to between the writer and the reader, and between the fans of these are the types of emotional interactions that we will be coming to expect.
Yeah, the choice, I think, to put this interaction not only on the same day as the anniversary party, which is heartbreaking, but also at the tail end of this hard-won victory for their relationship and for the puzzle. Like, they finally have this moment where, like, things are good and they're treating each other well and they're respecting each other. And, like, that's weird, but, like, they're working on that. And they're getting through it and they solved the thing that they couldn't solve. And it's not the next chapter. It's that chapter. It's like, hey, we are doing a horror story. It's gonna be sad.
Yeah. And honestly, as someone who generally avoids stuff like that, I'll have to look back through my text messages with my friend Tom, but I like the fury that comes to the person that recommends the book to you as this moment is delivered. You are like, I thought you were my friend.
Yeah.
The betrayal feels personal because you see in your friends who have loved this book and love these characters, this passion and this affinity and this connection. And you're like, wow, they really love these characters and they really love this story. I want to get in on that. And then it's just this like knuckle knives right to the sternum. Like, it is this cruel hit. And as someone who's not used to that as a reader, fucking oof, bruv.
Yeah. And the choice to start with the dad friend, the choice to start with literally the first person who had like ever, I guess technically he wasn't the first person to be nice to Gideon, but like Magnus stood out because he was wholesome. And we only a little bit met Abigail, but Magnus was the first person who really stood out to Gideon as somebody who was kind to her from that sort of like adultier position and in a way that wasn't sexualized. Like,
and in a way that he had nothing specific to gain from her. He had no need to manipulate her. It was
I interrupted you. Could you say that again?
and like, yes, other people have been nice in ways to Gideon before, but Magnus, unlike Teacher, unlike Eglemine, has nothing to gain. He just wants to be like, hey, kid, welcome to Kanan House. Like, I'm Magnus. Like, he's just a good guy who wants to be a good person to other people. And that maybe is the first time that Gideon has experienced something like that in her life.
I'm feeling very aware also of what it was like to hit this moment for the first time, because I remember coming to you and talking about this and you were like, oh my God, I know. Isn't the loss of Abigail like so devastating? And I was like, who? Because we really don't get to know Abigail until Harrow. And so you remembering that moment as somebody who saw Abigail the psychopomp, it becomes really about Abigail. But in Gideon's perspective on the day, it's really about Magnus.
It is. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's the loss. Because she's still like, her recent interactions with Abigail have been very like, huh.
She met Abigail substantively literally today. Yeah. And she seemed nice. Fine. She's a fine lady. She's a lady. Wasn't actively mean, which, hey, that's not a long list. But, you know, like, but Magnus, like, really connected for her.
Yeah.
And over time, Magnus made a point to be kind to her over several days where no one else was being kind to her, where she felt really isolated and really emotionally vulnerable. And Abigail is like a woman who wasn't actively mean.
Yeah. you know, none of the other Cavaliers saw it necessary to interact with Gideon in this way, or even interact with any of the other Cavaliers in this way. And Gideon, and like Magnus has specifically, with Gideon, gone out of his way to have this relationship with Gideon. He doesn't have this relationship with Babs. He doesn't have this relationship with Camilla. He doesn't have this relationship with any of the other Cavaliers. He says, "This kid, I want to connect with this kid."
As we've sort of pointed out, yeah, it's the only person that he had that sort of similar relationship with was Jean-Marie. The other two was there.
Gonna cry. My babies. It is such a beautifully delivered blow, and I think we're starting to see this fantastic pattern within Mira's writing of this theme, this contrast, and then this final delivery. Because this final line in this chapter is foreshadowed by the final line in chapter 15. Hera was like, "We gotta get into the chamber. We gotta go do the experiment," because she sees Abigail. She sees Abigail's competency, and she's like, "She's gonna be in there within 5 hours." And I'm like, "Yep, that's true." They just barely followed, like, forgive my phrasing, but just barely followed them down the ladder. And there is this tenderness in the way that their bodies are described that reminds me, I remember listening to an audiobook as a child, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, the original story, which in some ways is deeply horrifying. In one of the final scenes of the book, it describes some people opening up a space and discovering two bodies in an embrace, one holding the other tenderly, and the apparentness that one had died before the other. And just this, like, particularly heartrending description of these two bodies found that reminds me, like, these two descriptions remind me so much of each other, because it's like in death, as in life, there is this constant intimacy and care and commitment, even in this incidental moment of like Quasimodo. Quasimodo couldn't have controlled exactly what his body did as his died, but he has Esmeralda in his arms, and the way that Magnus and Abigail's bodies are described is that their closeness is not lost in this moment. And like that to me was devastating.
Yeah. And
Like,
that Gideon finds this sort of unbelievable. She makes these asides that's like, but that's not really what was happening. It looks like that, but it only looks like that.
I'm just gonna cry about that for a minute.
Yeah,
Because
valid.
it's so like, in a way, a gift to them in the end, like, of that was never taken away from them.
Yeah, it makes it so clear they died as a team. This was not family annihilation. This was not they betrayed each other in the end. This was not like there's no level of ambiguity that something was done to them and they were on the same team until that last second.
Which is both cruel and kind in the same breath.
As we get that drop, as we the next thing that happens after the clarification of what happened, face to face in the print copy is the cover front piece, the page for Act Three. And so we have this moment of this death. This death is confirmed. We're told who died, and then it's like, you are out of rising action, and you are now in the real fight. Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is Han. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's nunpod.com. Or get our attention online with the hashtag nunpod. Thanks for listening.